little news article. And it could be a news article, but the reference in the news article might be a CDC report, the World Health Organization information, and so on and so on. You can even get specific geography locations down to the county level, and all manners of things. So you can see the languages at the top. They have a special one for H1N1 tracking. You can even put it on this phone app to find what outbreaks are near me, put it under your zip code and so on. There's a wide variety of international medical journals and so on, World Health Organization, everything else is always given that. And they even mention animal diseases and so on, World Health Organization. Going down the side here, you have a list of a wide variety of diseases. One to go to the top, but there's just zillions of different kinds of critters that people can have. Okay? And what you want to do is probably check on the none and then add back to what you want to look for. Now there will be these sites on tuberculosis, and you just click on one, and it'll give you the news story and the citation for the site. You can adjust the timeline. This happens to be for this 2-week period of time, you can adjust the timeline and go back into different kinds of time ranges. Okay? So the shorter the time range, the fewer number of illnesses will help you in terms of finding something. And then you can simply zero in on something. Well, it's just a Google map thing, so you can focus it on anywhere in the world to write it down and so on. So if you want to know what's going on in your dog or tuberculosis, you just click on it and it goes but basically, it will pop up the information you're looking for. So that's sort of a fun thing. Again, that's healthmap.org. Of course, I have it in English, but you can have it in other languages as well. Some interesting information relative to, say, H1N1. Norway has reported in the last few days that they have isolated some mutants that seem to be a little more virulent than the normal H1N1. That's not good news. We also find in Wales, they reported several cases of Tamiflu-resistant forms of H1N1. All of these sort of worldwide sentinels, eventually what you hear in Norway, Wales, and Zimbabwe will your doorstep over time. So it's sort of an interesting way of keeping track of what's going on in the bug world. Also, if you hear something in the news, you can go back to the source, and then from the source, many times you go back to a CDC report or a World Health Organization report and so on, if it's a significant one. So you can get a little more up-to-date, precise interpretation. So if someone goes into your store, you're working in a retail setting, and they say, have you heard the latest about whatever? It could be the recent one about nasal spray that has bacteria in it or something like that. Those kind of things go all beyond it because once they've been reported in paper, they're reported electronically. If you report electronically, it'll pop up on this. In fact, it pops up on this system someplace between 5 and 7 days sooner than the CDC's system of getting information. And so they actually know about it sooner than does the CDC, as it turns out. CDC is probably trying to use it. Okay. Looking forward to the next exam, I think it's 2 weeks from today. Looking at the syllabus yesterday with somebody, and I think the syllabus had the wrong day. It says it's Thursday, but it's the right day. So it's a Tuesday of the last week of class. Okay. So we talked about T cells and B cells, and we talked about how the B cell system has on its surface a surface receptor site, which is basically the antibody. The antigen binds to that, selects the appropriate B cell, which it divides into its memory cell, to respond next time, the memory response, and plasma cells will secrete antibody within 10 to 14 days initially, and 5 to 7 days or so. The second explosion. Then we have the cell-mediated immune response, CMI, and Similarly, we have a T-cell receptor. It doesn't look exactly like antibody, but we'll see a little bit later how much similar it is to antibody in that. And the same thing happens, we activate the T-cell system. There are subpopulations of the cytotoxic and helper cells, and others we'll see, and a memory T-cell. And the activated cells will then secrete cytokines, or lymphokines, since they're coming from a lymphocyte. And they will have effects on the cells, if it's a helper cell, it's going to help these cells in the antibody. If it's a T-cell helper, then it's going to be helping the T-cells to make things, and so on. So they're sort of analogous to cytokine secretion, similar to the antibody. This one occurs a little faster, 4 days the first time, 2 days the second time, basically because of the system is a series of cytokine releases that affect on every cell. So it's a natural amplification. One activated T cell can affect possibly millions of other cells, giving a signal of some sort that you can determine that the reaction is occurring. Because of that natural amplification, you get a better sense in real time how quickly it's reacting. Whereas in B cells, when they have a plasma cell secreting antibody, that takes a long time to develop levels that are detectable in the bloodstream. So you do have those different timelines, or you have an exam or any place that you recognize the timeline differences. But in reality, at the cellular level, the reaction time is probably pretty much the same. Just the effects are related. Immunodeficiencies. We can have what we call genetic and or congenital. Let's just make sure we understand what this word means. Genetic obviously is referring to the germline problem, a genetic problem, DNA change, a mutation of some sort. And the congenital aspect of it indicates when that defect is observed, when it occurs. Now something can be in utero and therefore you can be born with it, that would be congenital, but it might not be genetic. It could be environmental. Mother's nutritional status or vitamins that she did or didn't take. Those can influence the outcome and development of the baby. And as a result, it may be a congenital problem, but not a genetic problem. And you're probably all familiar with pregnant women taking vitamins like folic acid and things like that. And folic acid helps prevent neural tube defects, that is, during the fetal development, of what will become the backbone and the nerve cord inside it. The defect there can result in spinal bifida, open spine. And that's associated with lower intakes of folic acid. So that would be congenital, but obviously it's not genetic. And so sometimes those terms are used almost synonymously without thinking genetic, but they are really two different kinds of things. Now there are many kinds of problems that can occur with the development of the immune system. We're not going to go through every known problem. We just want to use them as Medawar, one of the early Nobel Prize winners in immunology, called these experiments of nature. It's sort of a knockout mouse kind of thing, where we have everything but something working. And then we find out what that thing that's missing is what it's really doing. And so we'll look at some of these and we'll play with them, so to speak. And we'll be possible test question kind of case studies in the lab. Okay, so here the first one we want to look at is severe combined immunodeficiency, or SCID. This is a precursor then of both T cell and B cells. You lose the lymphoid cell. And without a lymphoid cell, then you don't have T or B cells. So it's a combined immunodeficiency, meaning both humoral and cellular control are responsible for lacking. We also can have a T cell problem in which there's a lack of development of a thymus. And that leads to something known as de Jorge syndrome. And these patients then have little in the way of T cell development. Okay, so we'll say the T cell deficient. So we'll look at that. And there's several different kinds of B cell problems. They can be at the level of an individual kind of antibody. So you can have a selective deficiency, for example, see down here. Selective deficiency, you cannot make, let's say, IgG or IgA or whatever. Okay, so you might not be able to make a particular kind of immunoglobulin. And there's indications of sex-linked kinds of things, X-linked and so on. But we're going to just of me instead of the excellent one. And ame in front of something obviously means absence. So gamma globulin is another name for antibody. And it refers to its electrophoretic position when you electrophorese the serum, including an electrical field across. And A, gamma globulinemia, anemia referring to bloodstream. So that means there's no antibody in bloodstream. So that's what Grootzen's is. So that would be a B cell problem. So we have a B cell problem, that is no humoral immunity. A T cell problem, meaning no CMI or immunity. And a combined immune deficiency, no T or B cell, no humoral or cellular response. On this side, we'll give you chronic granulomatous disease. We're going to indicate that chronic granulomatous disease is really a problem with both neutrophils and mononuclear cells. We're drawing serum first as neutrophils, but really it's a problem with both. So both our phagocytic cells are not working. So that would be neutrophils and then macrophages. Now here we have a George patient, and remember this is something that's developing in utero, and they were born without thymus, and therefore they have no T cells. But if you look at this child, you may notice a few other things which are not quite right. What do you notice? What's unusual about this child? This child ears, okay, so you got these spot things going on here. So the ears look a little malformed. Anything else? Yeah, the jaw is sort of a V shape. It's not the typical U shape. And that distorts the opening of the mouth, giving it a sort of O sign. Okay. Anything else? Eyelids. Did you say eyelids?
Yeah.
You're close. What it is the pupil distance appears to be a little longer than it's, a little wider than it's expected. And the nose area is a little flatter. So it's sort of, they sort of together give you this unusual appearance around the eyes. But you get the idea that we have problems, congenital problems, other than simply the T cell system. Okay. Thymus. What advantage would it be to notice that? Who would be observing this? What kind of physician would be observing this? Pediatrician. Okay, so when the doctor is looking at the baby, when the baby's born, and it's 1 month or 3 months, they check a variety of things. They check the malformed hips and so on. You can go see the examination and put them back, and they grab them by the legs and move them up and down and see if the kids work well and all that. But they're also going to be observing this. This will be a tip-off. You know, possible de jure or something like that will be written in the notes. And that means then that immunizations may not work as well in this child. As we'll see, the role of T helpers when he's missing is going to be significant in the development of even antibody responses. So the typical child immunizations will not be very effective. The increased likelihood of infections is going to be there. We can expect this child to have multiple admissions to the hospital by the time they were 6 years of age. Multiple meaning 5, 6, 8. Okay. So all of this is just observed when you look at this fellow's face and ears and so on. Now here we have a mouse, and there's some few things wrong with this mouse. This is a so-called nude mouse. And it is the experimental model for SIDS, severe combined immune deficiency. No T cells and no B cells, but also notice there are some other issues. Notably, no hair, and the nude mouse. Anything else you might notice about the mouse? What's that? He's wrinkled. Now, that's probably what it looks like without the hair. It's just a phenomenon of not seeing it all covered up. Eyes, yes. Now, the ears look a little bit big, but that's probably also because you normally see them covered with fur. But the eyes are... Oops. You have a copy of the mouth. It'll appear again. The eyes are the phenomena. Okay. And these mice are blind. The degree of anomaly of the eyes varies. It can be there but not functional, but many times they're not even fully developed. And then occasionally there's not even an eyeball or even a slit. There's varying degrees of loss of presence of ocular structures, but in terms of function, they're blind. Three blind mice, this is involved three blind mice. Alright, so here we have just out of one of the textbooks, the immunology textbook. And in the immunology textbook, they have a variety of questions at the end of the chapters. And unlike your Algebra 2 book in high school, it answers all the questions, not just simply the even of the odd. This is obviously a little game or a diagram of immunodeficiencies. And we talked about severe combined immunodeficiency, that would be 3. And we talked about a B-cell problem and a T-cell problem, so you can see where it might be. And chronic granulomatous disease. So far, in terms of immunodeficiency, and we've just heard of the gun, we talked about T-cell, we talked about alcoholics and diabetics. We talked about SCID patients a little bit more. The George and the Rubens patients and granulomatous disease patients. Well, you get a better handle of what's going on. And let's clarify some of the things that I've laid out already, but you may not get this full import of. You need to understand some basic Nobel Prize information. And this is the first one, the clonal selection theory. 1960, a big old time, right? 1960 Nobel Prize with Claude Burnett and Peter Medawar. That was even before I was really involved in it. But Burnett was a notable fellow in the 60s and the early 70s, and so when I was interested in going to graduate school, I actually wrote Burnett in Australia to find out what school to go to. Go to a medical school. So I went to the University of Buffalo Medical School for PhD program because of the discussions I had with Medawar. Medawar was certainly an interesting fellow. He's an Australian, and he was the first one to tackle, with some degree of success, how it was possible for us to have an immune system that works. Now we said that the antigen came and selected the appropriate B cell or T cell. And that B cell, for example, would be sitting in the spleen lymph node, and the antigen would come and select the appropriate one, and it triggers the divide. Well, if you think about what that really means, that means that the B cell is sitting there waiting for its antigen. Okay? That means that the B cell specifically designed for that antigen was made before you came in contact with the antigen. So that means that you are born with 10 to the 8th, 10 to the 12th, as the number turns out, 10 to the 8th, 10 to the 12th, different B cells waiting in a resting mode for their antigen to come. To put that in a practical sense, we could, in the organic chemistry class, develop a new structure that's never been seen before, inject it into a rabbit or a college freshman or somebody, and then they would have a response to it. They would have a new response to something that didn't exist until this morning. They were waiting for that antigen to come before we even developed the antigen, before it was even made the first time. This is sort of interesting. I'm like, how do you do that? Well, there was one theory that was called an instructive theory, that the antigen came along and directed the synthesis of the antibody. That didn't make a whole lot of sense in a practical sense. How would you do that? It defied the basic laws of protein synthesis in messenger RNA for proteins, and how would that happen? So that one fell apart with molecular biology. And then they came across with a germline theory that says, well, every B cell has the capacity to make all these things, and they're just bristling with all these different possibilities. And it's all genetically determined ahead of time. Then people got a pencil and paper and tried to figure out how much genomic information would have to be in every cell of the body, because of course B cells and T cell lymphocytes are really no different than epithelial cells and brain tissue and heart tissue with respect to the DNA inside. The only difference ones are sperm and egg at half. So if you knew recombination, you have to have a bushel basket of DNA in every cell. And that's not likely. I mean, 10 to 8 to 10 to 12 different proteins, that's a lot. So Burnett came up with the idea that during fetal development, there's a period of rapid mutation. And the end result of this rapid mutation would be the 10 to the 8 to 10 to 12 different possibilities. So it wasn't that you had it in your genetic information, other than that you had some sort of box, we'll call it, or some sort of system that would generate randomness. In fact, one group of British, they have a strange sense of humor in England, British researchers published a paper called the Gene of Diversity Project. God. Gene of Diversity, G-O-D. Anyway, so they had God doing this, the Gene of Diversity. Generating some sort of random number program kind of equivalent on the genetic level. But that's the one helping to do this. So Burnett said this is how it is. It's a random mutation. And Medawar, who was English and didn't like the Australians at all, in particular did not like Burnett, stood up at the meeting and said, well, very fascinating idea you have. Unfortunately, it's not working. You can't be right. And in fact, had your idea been correct, you would have been aborted in your mother's womb because you would have developed an immune response to yourself as a result of this random crazy idea you have, and therefore you would have been destroyed in utero, and maybe that would have been a good idea. That's sort of a crude and nasty thing to say at a public meeting. So they didn't get off on a good note. Okay? So Burnett went back and licked his wounds a little bit and back to Australia, and he came up with the fact that if during the first 30 days or so, you develop an immune response that would be to yourself, you destroy that particular B cell. We call it the forbidden clone. And so therefore, you have the possibility of making 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 12 minus self. That you lose the capacity, destroy it, you say, in his initial work, the capacity to respond to self. We now know that they're not really destroyed, but they are specifically suppressed. And if that suppression or tolerance, as we call it, is lost, sometimes a loss of tolerance, they actually develop autoimmune disease. So you retain the ability to respond to yourself, but you are under control, self-control, not to. If you lose that self-control, then you develop what we call an autoimmune disease. The classic one you've heard of already probably is lupus, systemic lupus erythematosus, but there are dozens. Okay. So he presented that paper, and Medawar says, no, I'm tired of this stuff. He says, I'm going to go back to London, and I've got friends at the vet, hospital vet school, and cows often have dizygotic twins. That is, one mother-father combination, okay? But the twins are no more like than brother or sister, but they share dizygotic, meaning two eggs, sperm combination, but they share the same placenta. These dizygotic twins in the same placenta would share the same circulatory system. So in the first 30 days, they would see each other as self, according to Burnett's idea, and of course Medawar says it's baloney. And if that happened, then they have a double exclusion of self. And even though they're different blood groups, cows have blood groups, different blood groups, male, female, completely different individuals except the same parents. And as a result, if they did this sharing of circulatory system, then immunologically they'd have a double exclusion of self, and therefore they would not see each other as foreign, and you could take skin from one to the other and blood transfusions and so on, and that just can't be. I'm tired of your theoretical stuff, let's make it real. So Medawar goes back to London and proves McFarlane Burnett correct. And he has these pictures of cows with their black fur cows with a big white patch on it that they got from their placentamates. Skin grafts without rejection. Blood groups exchanged without rejection. Just as Burnett predicted, Medawar proved. A little grumpy about it, but they got over it when they shared the Nobel Prize. Okay, so the whole story then is in the prize I got a twin as the experimental model. What that looks like in diagrammatic form, we have the original stem cell in utero. We have the genetic rearrangement that results in these different kinds of receptors on the surface of B cells. Again, these are antibody-like structures. And each one binds to a different target. In the antigen then later on, after you develop the cell, an antigen comes along and matches one of these, so the antigen selects the one. It's shown four here, but we really have 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 12, that's a big number. And we have four possibilities then shown, and we have antigen numbers, so it comes along and selects two, stimulates it to divide, so we have a clone. And from the clone, we get the memory cell and the plasma cell secreting antibody to the antigen. So we have antigen-dependent proliferation. So the antigen comes along and triggers the division. That's what occurs when your lymph nodes are both blown up. We had antigen-independent proliferation and gene rearrangement during fetal life, early on. Well, the implications are a couple of things. Sequestered tissue, things that are not there on day 30 or so, will be seen as foreign even though they are self. And we talked about a little bit about in the introduction that if the testes can be involved, if the patient has post-progressive male, has mumps and so on, that can result in sterility. We also have the sympathetic ophthalmia where we have damage done to the one eye with trauma of some sort, car accident, not blast, whatever. And then the other eye gets destroyed later. If you don't quickly enucleate the first eye, it stimulates an energetic response that triggers a new response to destroy the other eye. So instead of just having blind, one eye blind, you're now blind in both eyes. There's also the immunogenetics related to infection risk. For example, blood group B is found on other tissues, just like A is. They're found in nature. And it's because they're found in nature, which means they're on microorganisms and food and things like that. If you're a group B person, you will develop antibodies to the A substance because you run across that in nature and you have no reason not to produce the immune response. But you don't do it to B. You're blinded to B. It turns out certain bacteria, Salmonella being one of them, but certain kinds of bacteria have lots of B antigen on it. And if you're a group B person, you don't respond as strongly to that organism as group A people would. And that then results in increased risk of infection. So we do see different infection rates with different blood groups because of this sort of immunological blindness. It is that same blindness we talked about with respect to only 85% of the population responding to hepatitis B surface antigen vaccine, 15% not. We think that 15% that doesn't respond is an overlap of self. And just because in that particular vaccine we have the recombinant antigen, which is a very small in terms of size and number of antigen structures on it. So we're not stimulating a whole bunch of B cells or T cells. Tissue transplantation, we'll talk about the implications of tissue transplantation and the whole idea of tissue typing and so on a little later. Well, the second Nobel Prize came along a little later in 1984, and that was monoclonal antibodies. Milstein, Kohler, Gurney. What this was about was that based on the earlier diagram, there is a B cell marked number 2, and theoretically you can get just that one to respond if you have antigen number 2 small enough. The problem was twofold. One, we couldn't get an antigen that would just stimulate one B cell. That was hard to do. And secondly, if we couldn't get it small enough. And secondly, when we got it really, really small, it didn't stimulate any responses, so it got too small to respond. So it was just sort of a theoretical consideration, but we couldn't get any practical application of it. So these guys developed a different way of doing it. And we've got a term here that we're going to be using more commonly now, because we can appreciate what the definition is. Here we have an antigen. We've been using the term antigen or antigenic determinant. Technically, the smallest part of the antigen that you respond to is an epitope. So that's a new term for us, and we'll have to remember how to use that. Epitope is the smallest antigen. So this antigen has four epitopes. Each one will stimulate a particular single B cell. We inject this antigen with four epitopes into a mouse. The mouse begins to have an immune response, and we can determine that by looking at the antibodies in the serum. It's called polyclonal antisera, because we've got antibodies to 1, 2, 4, as you'd expect. We then sacrifice the mouse, and we run its spleen cells through a screen, and we get to sieve the mouse. And we have isolated cells. So there's our isolated plasma cells there. One secreting antibody 1, and 2, or 3, or 4 episodes. And we merge these with myeloma cells. Myeloma is a B-cell tumor. And we take a myeloma cell that is a tumor cell, so it grows easily on its own. It meets its own nutritional needs. But it has genetic deletion, so it no longer produces antibody. So the B cell, the plasma cell, can't produce antibody, but it can easily grow a myeloma cell. And from there, we merge them together, and we get these hybrids, or hybridomas, a mixture of the original plasma cell and the myeloma cell. We then dilute these out in a series of wells to the point where we have isolated clones, and we then get pure antibody 1, 2, 3, or 4. These pure antibodies to a particular epitope is called a monoclonal antibody. Now you might wonder why we don't simply culture these plasma cells and dilute them out and grow them in cell culture or something. The problem here is that first line cells are hard to get to grow in a cell culture. They don't grow very well, they die out after 2 or 3 replications, whereas tumor cells can grow on and on and on. One of the early tumor cells we had was a tumor from a woman by the name of Helen Lang. And we called them HeLa cells. Helen Lang, HeLa, first 2 letters of her name. Helen Lang, HeLa. And so the HeLa cells were actually used for probably 30 or 40 years with multiple kinds of deletions and changes and so on. But they were this woman's cell that outlived her by decades. That's the advantage of a tumor. It grows easily, even outside the body. Whereas the original line, first line cells are hard to grow. So that's why we create these hybrid cells. When I give the lectures on this topic for a biotechnical, we'll go into much more detail because they may be involved in making monoclonal antibodies. So you can see a little more detail in reality. But basically, it's the same thing, and we end up with the myeloma cells, and again, they are immortal, so they grow easily, and they do not produce antibody. And here we have the mortal ones from the mouse that do produce antibody. We blind them together. Notice we're using antifreeze, ethylene glycol, polyethylene glycol, to merge them together to create these hybrids. All manners of possibilities occur when you do that. We have to select 4 of them. But once we do that, you don't need to worry about the details of that. We can then grow it, and we grow in cell culture, and we can actually put it into animals, and it'll develop a peritoneal fluid called a Sinus fluid, and in that fluid, we'll have monoclonal antibodies. Patients with certain kinds of tumors will also have very enlarged abdominal areas with lots of fluid in it, and that's also the same as Sinus fluid. So we can grow this in animals, or we can grow it in cell culture. Usually it's done in cell culture. Now the use of these monoclonal antibodies are twofold. First off, we can use those to identify microorganisms. And we can take the antibody and put a fluorescent label on it, so wherever it glows. We take a sample from the patient, for example, this is commonly done for chlamydia, an eye infection. So we take the swab on the kind of side of the eye and roll it across the slide. We have the organism there, or not. We don't know what's there, for sure. We got cells because we just scraped it, so there's new cells there. We then add a fluorescent label antibody that will bind to chlamydia, and we look under a fluorescent microscope, and we can see chlamydia there glowing. So we use the antibody as a marker. Notice that we can do this in one step without growing the organism. It's particularly helpful for chlamydia. You may recall chlamydia requires a host cell's culture to grow. We need to have a culture growing there, and it takes maybe 4 to 6 weeks to get enough growth to actually do the identification of the organism. What a procedure with monoclonal antibody takes about 20 minutes. Usually it's done in the reference lab, so practically we send the sample in, and the next morning we get a call back and get an email giving us the results. It's a lot quicker than 6 weeks. Right. So we can use them for identifying microorganisms. And we use a variety of microorganisms that we do this with, viruses and bacteria. The commonality is that we do We don't need to get a pure culture of it. We don't need to do a testing for antimicrobial susceptibility like the Kirby-Bauer or the Nipton and inventory concentration MIC. So the Kirby-Bauer and MIC don't need to be done because if we know the organism, we know how to treat it. Most organisms, there's antimicrobial resistance, which means we do have to get it in pure culture. We do have to grow it in the presence of the organism, the antibiotics, to find out what works. So monoclonal antibodies is a good idea, but it's a limited application in terms of an indication. We can use it to identify a tumor in a patient's body by attaching, instead of a fluorescent label, we attach a heavy metal compound or some sort of radio opaque substance, and wherever it goes, it will then outline the tumor. If we know we have an antibody to the tumor, we can put some sort of toxin attached to that antibody, and wherever the antibody goes, it releases the toxin and destroys the tumor. So we can use it for therapy. So we can use it for identification, for imaging, and for therapy. There's monoclonal antibodies that are used for breast cancer, for example. So many different uses here. Now, there are some clinical problems associated with this, and it all has to do with the fact that this idea of epitope. The monoclonal antibody, number two in our earlier list there, antibody 204, that monoclonal antibody is epitope specific. If we are looking for an organism or a tumor or to treat a tumor, to identify a tumor, if we pick an epitope on the surface of that target that is unique to that target, always found on that target, and only found on that target, everything works well. But if we pick a target that's not found on all tumors, or not found on all chlamydia, or whatever it might be, then we match up the ones we know about, and the ones we miss are really false negatives. It comes up negative because it didn't match, but in fact it was there and we just didn't see it. So if we use if we don't have the target 100% covered with that epitope, if all the targets aren't covered with that epitope, then we're going to miss some targets. It's not because the antibody is at fault, it's because we selected the wrong target. Also, if we check, so then we give us false negatives. If we detect an epitope that's found on the tumor or the microorganism or whatever, and found on all of them, so it sounds good, found on all examples of the tumor, all examples of the microorganism, but it's also shared with normal epithelial cells or some other target. Not the tumor cell, not the microorganism. Now we have false positives. Okay? True enough, the monoclonal antibody is matching to the target we're looking for, but it also matches other things. So when the clinical problems are associated with epitopes, we have to pick an epitope that is only found on the target and found on all the targets. And then we don't have problems. And sometimes we don't recognize these problems, false negatives, until after the product has gone through clinical trials, we just didn't test it enough people, and we're actually using the product and we realize that there are these false positives and false negatives. So it's an odd thing. We actually cheat for the reagent for chlamydia. We have found that the target that we use is not found on all chlamydia, but it is found on only chlamydia, so that's good news. And so we cheat. We actually use two targets. We mix two monoclonal antibodies together, and those, L1 and L2 as they're called, but those targets each are unique to chlamydia, but neither is found on all chlamydia. So we sort of cheat. It works just as well, but it is sort of a thing that we had to adjust during clinical trials. Here's some examples of some of the toxins that we can create, these so-called immunotoxins. We can put the antibody onto the target, poison onto the target. We use ricin, which is from the castor bean, biological origin. Shigella toxin, diphtheria toxin, and so we have basically this immunotoxin. We have the antibody plus the disulfide bonds connecting us to the target. You'll notice disulfide bonds are intimately associated with the structure of antibodies, so you can easily use disulfide bonds to add things. Here we see on the left-hand side what happens normally with diphtheria toxin. It's got two parts, one that binds to the target cell, the yellow one there, and then one that actually has the toxin to it. And so it attaches to the surface of the cell, brought into the cell, and then the poisonous, so-called poisonous part, interferes with elongation factor number two, which you may have heard about in biochemistry in terms of protein synthesis. It's like a growing chain of amino acid linkages. So it interferes with elongation factor number two. Here we see the genotoxin. We put the little red box on there, that's the toxin part that interferes with elongation factor number two. But instead of having it select one of your cells, we have it select a tumor cell. So we have a tumor-specific antigen, that's the epitope that comes only on the tumor. And we have an antibody to it, and the antibody is this genotoxin that's brought inside, and therefore it interferes with making a protein synthesis in the tumor cell. So it selectively destroys the tumor cell. Now, when we use the antibody, we often would use like a mouse antibody or something like that, other than a human antibody. And of course, the mouse antibody is made by mice, obviously not. And we will see the mouse protein, including a mouse antibody, as a foreign protein. And therefore, the patients receiving the monoclonal antibody for breast cancer could have a reaction by trying to attack their immune response to the mouse antibody. So we want to remove as much as possible of the mouseness of the amino acid sequence of the antibody as possible. The part that of the antibody that's binding to the tumor will retain, and the rest of it will replace, just a little bit of chemical engineering here, a little bit of protein engineering, and we put the rest of it with human amino acid sequences. Okay, so we can take this antibody apart. It's not a magical thing, it's a tool. And so we disassemble it and reassemble it, and we keep the mouse part for the target that interacts with the epitope. So this portion of the antibody interacts with the target epitope. And the rest of it we can change, because it's not really involved in that process, to the human. So we have a chimera. Chimera in the Greek mythology, man, horse kind of thing. Right? And so we have a chimera, we have the human-mouse mixture. So this is what we made in the lab, initially from the mouse, and this is what we actually inject in the patient. There's many different kinds of chimeras. This is the typical one that we use. So antibodies, we've seen a little bit about its stick structure. It looks like a stick structure. So we're looking at structure and function of the antibody. Now here's again our stick function, stick structure kind of thing. This is the part that binds the epitope. So we say it's the antigen binding fraction. And this particular molecule has two of these. So we can bind two different molecules with the same epitope. We call this one the fraction, the antigen binding activity, or the FAB. So this is an FAB portion here, and this is an FAB portion here. So the rest of the molecule, so from about this tail piece right in here, back, is called the, from this disulfide bond back, is called the FC region. The initial work done by the biochemists, they applied their thought process to the investigation, and they were very interested in proteins that they could get in pure form. That is, a fraction that was crystallizable. And this sort of tail portion from this disulfide bond back, the tail portion could be easily crystallized because there was very few amino acid sequence variations. So they thought that was really neat and important. It turned out in terms of the biological activity of the antibody, it's not all that important in terms of binding of antigen at least. It has importance, but not binding the antigen. So because they could get it in pure form, because of the amino acid sequence was not much changed, that was the fraction that was crystallizable. So we have one end of the molecule which has been crystallized, the other end has many amino acid sequence variations because it has to fit the 10 to the 8 to 10 to 12 different targets. And so there's lots of amino acid sequence variations out here, the fraction that was the FAB portion, because that has to fit with all the different kinds of antibodies. So just as we saw in terms of the chimera, this portion of the FAB is the portion that changes the tip of the epitope. The rest of it doesn't change much. Remember in the chimera, part that didn't change was the part that we basically took from the human portion of them. The mouse portion is the part that was all in all the different specificities. The other thing to note here is the hinge region. A couple of things that we note about the antibody. One is composed of a couple of chains. We see this big chain called the heavy chain and the shorter chain called the light chain. So they're molecular weights, one is heavy, one is light. They're held together by disulfide bonds. That's all these little lines here. So we have heavy chains and light chains. We have disulfide bonds. We have a portion with the amino acid sequence changes a lot, and a portion that it doesn't change a lot. And finally, when an antigen or epitope binds to the FAB region, it triggers a conformational change noted by the action of the hinge region. That is, it actually moves. Away from where the antigen is binding, it actually has movement, conformational change. So those are characteristics of antibodies. Disulfide bonds, multiple chains. One end of the chain changes a lot in the acid sequence. The other end of the chains do not. Conformational change. All of these are part of what we call the super immunoglobulin family. These are family characteristics. Family characteristics. So they're part of a broader group of proteins called the super immunoglobulin family. That T cell receptor that we talked about a moment ago earlier, that's part of the super immunoglobulin family too. It's got multiple chains held together by disulfide bonds. It's got one end of chains to the antigen, and so on and so on and so on. Now, one of the other features about the FC region is that it also, in many cases, not all, but in many cases, will bind to a cell. So the FC stands for fraction that's crystallizable, but it's also the portion that may bind to a cell. So we'll use that C there as a memory clue. And so it can fit on the surface of the cell. In fact, remember the B cell? That's exactly what's happening. And so it's sitting there with the FC buried in the membrane. And we can see several examples of that kind of idea. So the biochemists began to play with the molecule first. Here's our basic molecule, the heavy light chains, disulfide bonds. If they used papain, they got the FABs by themselves and the FC all by itself. That was the fraction of the crystallizable. So this is the part that binds the antigen. Actually, this portion right here. But this is the part that binds the antigen. And this is the fraction that was crystallizable in pure form. If they used pepsin, it chews up the FC region in many sites, because obviously these enzymes attack at certain amino acid sequences. And in the case of pepsin, there are multiple targets for that amino acid sequence attack, resulting in various fragments of all the FC. But we end up with this sort of wing structure. So we're cutting it from here down. We end up with this wing structure, which is called FAB prime 2. So we have FAB, which we get two of them, and FAB prime 2, in which we get one of them. It's just a matter of where the target amino acids are. Finally, if we use a reducing agent like 2-mercaptoethanol kappa ethanol, which basically adds the hydrogen to all the disulfide bonds and cleaves it up, we end up with these little chains. So all these disulfide bonds are reduced, and we end up with heavy light chains. This has no biological activity. So that was the contribution to the biochemistry. Now let's take a look at this molecule a little bit more. We're going to see this repeatedly. Now what we're looking at is a stick figure model. To give you an idea of what we mean by a model here, this is true of any kind of model, this model of an antibody. Are you familiar with blind men describing an element? Just a handful of people. You need to be educated. It's a concept. Right? So here's a way of thinking about something. If we have five blind men describing an element in India, one blind man fills the wall of the elephant, the side of the elephant, and says, this elephant is like a wall. Another one fills the leg, and says, no, the elephant is like a column. I don't understand why you say it's like a wall. One's got the tail and says, oh, elephant, that's like a piece of rope. Somebody's got the trunk and says, oh, elephant is like a snake. Somebody's got the ears and says, no, an elephant is like a palm leaf. I know exactly what one of them is wrong. Elephant isn't a palm leaf in the wall and a column in the snake and a rope. But collectively, they're still wrong. Collectively, an elephant is an accommodation of those. It's not a pile of those things. So a model is just like that. A model is accurate in what it's describing, but it not necessarily can be extrapolated to other things. So the model of the blind man, yes, an elephant is like a wall, sort of, in one way, but an elephant is not a wall. An elephant is like a palm leaf, it is not a palm leaf, and so on. Okay? So these are models of antibodies. They are all exactly correct about some aspect and completely wrong about others. Okay? That's the way models work. And typically, when students see a model, they say, ah, an elephant is like a palm leaf. I know what elephants are like. Because they got the one model in mind and they don't realize that the model has limitations. Okay? So this is the stick figure model. You've seen it a couple of times, but it's not the only one we're going to show you. Now, this particular stick figure model, we have the amino acids in the regions here that we see. And we have disulfide bonds holding the chains together. And we also note now that there are intra-chain disulfide bonds. So more disulfide bonds. Remember I said there's lots of disulfide bonds associated with the molecule. If we look at the amino acid sequence variations, remember that chimera of the mouse and the human? Okay? The variable portion of the heavy chain is here. That's the variable heavy. And the constant heavy are three, constant heavy one, two, and three. These do not change much in the amino acid sequence. In the light chain, we also have the variable region and the constant region. So the variable regions are those areas that are going to change so that we can make an antibody to 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 12. Well, we don't have to make a whole new antibody molecule. So we stick those variations, so that we stick them onto constant regions. And if you remember that mouse human chimera, that's exactly what we saw there. We have the human part, the constant part, and the mouse part, the variable part. So we have these amino acid sequences. Now, in the light chains areas, we have two different amino acid sequences that are part of this constant region. We call them kappa or lambda. Kappa or lambda. Now, the cartoonist drew the line to the light chain, and that's sort of okay, but really they should have drawn it to the constant region of the light chain, because that's where these kappa and lambda sequences are. The variable regions can have all kinds of things that tend to be able to as well as an animal. So we have the light chain, constant regions are kappa or lambda. The heavy chain constant region, again, the first initially drawn it down here, these three regions, the heavy chain are five different possible. And we give these also the Greek letters. And we have mu chain and a gamma chain and an alpha, sigma, and an epsilon chain. And those would be associated with IgM, mu, IgG, gamma, IgA, alpha, and so on. And so the classes of antibody are determined by the amino acid sequence of the heavy chain constant region. So heavy chain, these are classes. The type of antibody is the light chain kappa or lambda. So light chain results in type. Heavy chain sequences result in class. So in the past, when we talked about IgG on the mucosal surface, or IgA in the bloodstream, and so on, we really are referring to the heavy chain concentration of that antibody. And there's only a handful of variations that allow, for example, the initial biochemist would then get pure forms of gamma, and mu, and so on. Now, if this was a philosophy class, we would word this a little differently, we would say maybe the heavy chain concentration defines determines the IgM-ness that would be mu, or the IgG-ness. But you can see that model falls apart, blossom model too. That would also determine the IgA-ness of the antibody, of course, the antibody don't have that structure. So anyway, so we got this idea here. And we also have the heme region. Okay, so when an antigen binds out here, it will then result in a flexing and conformational change here, which is then transferred through the rest of the heavy chain constant region. So this antibody antibody is sitting on the surface of a cell, it actually communicates binding here to the membrane of the cell that's attached to it. Now you can start seeing the role of superimmunoglobulin family molecules. They are really the center sites for cells. They are the eyes and ears, so to speak, of the cell. Only the ones that fall off, the ones we find interesting initially, that is, we talk about them as being antibodies and protective and so on. But before all that, they were left on the cell, and they still are. And so part of the role of this is not simply to simply bind, but also have a conformational change that will be transduced as a signal through the membrane of the cell in which it's attached, so that it says, well, our voltage arrived, the docking has occurred. That substance is out there, and we now can react to it. This is a B cell. The reaction is, okay, let's make more antibodies. And so it converts to a plasma cell and a memory cell and produces antibody from the plasma cell and so on. All of that began with this antigen selecting the appropriate B cell. But that's really a model system in which the outside world activates a cell. So the superimmunoglobulin family is more than simply the immune system. Now here we have another model. This model happens to put a predominance on this disulfide chain, and the interchain disulfide molecules are not here. And we have the amino acids now curled out around them. Here's another way of looking at it. Here we can see a different way of looking at that. We see a pleated sheet, you've heard that in my memory. We see a pleated sheet arrangement of these amino acids. Okay. And the pleated sheet arrangement, this would be the yellow is the heavy chain, or the blue is the heavy chain, and the rose colored or pink is the light chain. This would be the light variable, this would be the heavy variable, and this would be the light constant. This would be a heavy chain, constant 1, 2, and 3. So now we get a little better picture. When we talk about the antigen binding to the antibody, it's not the N-terminal here, this is the C-terminal here, not the N-terminal of these chains, not the N, but really someplace in here. Some place where heavy and light chain come together at a variable region. So it might be amino acid sequence, 123 to 127 on the heavy chain. And on the light chain, it might be 16 to 19. That little spot where they come together, that's where the epitope fits. Not necessarily the N-terminal, but really here. And how do we get a pocket for them to fit into? It might be an amino acid sequence change in the heavy chain number 112 that results in a different kinking, a little different pleating, which results this thing popping out, no longer a pocket, and something else popping in the pocket. That's how we can get so many variations with just slight amino acid sequence changes. Okay. So again, it's not in the N-terminal region, but rather it's someplace where heavy and light chain come together. So, another arrangement of antibody, of diamond, of a molecule. We have a space-filling molecule, same thing. Here we have the, I call it baby rattle approach. Okay. They're all different models showing different kinds of things, okay. But they're all showing antibody with antigen binding. So antigen-antibody interactions is a steric relationship, a fit. So there's a physical fitness to it. A bonding, and the bondings can be hydrogen bondings, ionic bondings, hydrophilic, hydrophobic interactions, and even those weird heat forces called the Van der Waal forces you had in inorganic chemistry. All of these come together between antigen and antibodies at some point where antigen and antibody come together. It's usually 3 to 5 amino acid residues of antibody interacting with the antigen. Those 3 to 5 amino acid residues are shared between between the variable heavy and the variable light, making a pop-up someplace. And this interaction is a dynamic situation. The antigen antibody coming together. We have an antibody that can bind to more than one antigen because we saw in our molecule that we have these two that can bind to. Antigen, likewise, can have multiple epitopes on its surface that are all the same. So we saw an antigen with epitope 1, 2, 3, 4. We could have an antigen that had 5,000 different targets on it that are all the same. So now we have an antigen-antibody interaction that can occur that's not one-to-one, but many-to-many. At least two parts on the antibody, at least two, we'll show you more in a moment, and multiple parts on the antigen. And that creates a lattice work. Not one antigen, one antibody, but hundreds of antigens and hundreds of antibodies all cross-linked together. So if you can imagine an antibody that binds to one molecule of antigen over here and one molecule of antigen over here, okay, and they in turn bind to others and so on and so on, and so we have this lattice work, antigen antibody. The size of that lattice work depends upon the relative concentrations of the two of them. When they're at or near equivalence in terms of receptor site interaction, we have the largest structure. If we have a predominance of one or the other, antigen excess or antibody excess, then the particle sizes are very small. Okay. So it's sort of like, let's say, boys and girls in the junior high school dance. Okay. So if there's roughly an even number of boys and girls in the dance floor in the gym, with their socks on and all that kind of stuff, if there's an even number, then they can pair up and so on. There's a lot of people on the dance floor. But if there are only three guys and 93 girls, then there's a small number of couples out there. Okay. And if there's three girls and 95 guys, there's a small number of couples. So at or near equivalence, we get the notion of those people on the dance floor. That's the same idea of this lattice work formation. Going back to our discussion earlier, we talked about post-streptococcal diseases, and one of them was glomerulonephritis. We said that about 14 days or so, after you've had the sore throat, they develop post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis. That's when you have the antigen and protein and the antibodies binding together, creating very large complexes, trapped in the kidney, activating complement, having an acute inflammation in the kidney. Okay. And so that's the only problem. We just give you a diuretic and send you home. And the reason we can do that is that you'll produce more and more antibody over time, and those large complexes are static. And so the more antibody you make, the fewer people on the dance floor. And pretty soon it's small enough that it's not being trapped by the kidney anymore, and it's washed out. So this idea of antigen and antibody coming together has specific biological clinical consequences of the reactions in the body. The larger the complexes occur at or near equivalence, you start with pure organism or pure antigen, and you gradually add more and more antibody, and at or near equivalence, which is usually about 10 to 14 days, that's when you have the biggest problem typically with these immune complex diseases. That's a specific term, ICD. Immune complex disease, which will occur in many places, but one of them will be the kidneys, wherever these things can be trapped. Other places in the body that they can be trapped would be in the heart, because of the strange circulatory system in the heart. So we have inflammation in the heart that can occur as an immune complex disease. In joints, think of rheumatoid arthritis, that's an immune complex disease. So how do we do that? We suppress the immune system so you don't produce any antibody. Okay. And so basically we have immune complex diseases. We have joint pain, kidney problems, heart problems. They're all the same mechanism. And if we produce enough antibody, we can be out of the problem. Okay. Because of the dynamic nature of this interaction. Some terminology. We've already mentioned the term epitope. Now the part of antibody that binds to the epitope is called the complementarity determining region, which is hard to say. Typically, we call it the idiotope. Boy, that's a funny term. So we have the epitope of the antigen interacting with the idiotope of the antibody. And these are, again, the chemists go crazy with little forms, but we don't worry about them too much. You can play with this on your own. But just remember that gamma is IgG and mu is IgM and so on down the line. There are subclasses that have slight variations of IgG And we'll talk about a few of them as we talk about some specific clinical entities a little later, but not to memorize. We don't worry about what IgG1 does with different diseases. We'll just simply mention it, but not to memorize. Kappa and lambda again. Now, when we have that two heavy chains and two light chains, that would be two kappas and two gammas, right? Two kappas and two lambda. Notice that a given antibody is all the same in terms of all kappa or all lambda. So they have two light chains, two kappas, two light chains, two lambdas, two kappas, or two gammas, the two heavy chains. So that was what we saw in terms of its molecular structure. Some of these will vary from that, and we'll see this in a moment. Here we go right there. Here we're using the baby rabbit model. Here's what IgG looks like, two heavies, two lights. Okay. IgD and IgE, two heavies and two lights. IgA, that secretory antibody without memory, the basis of the problem associated with traveler's diarrhea and stuff like that. It's a dimer. Here's our heavy chain, light chain combination of one monomer, and here's another monomer, and they're held together with something called J chain. Okay. Here's a J chain, creating a dimer. Then IgM, mu, which is our typically produced as our first antibody in the bloodstream. That first plasma cell in the bloodstream will often produce IgM. And here we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different monomers held together by J chain. But remember, the shape does not determine what it's called. It's the heavy chain concentration. The amino acid sequence in the heavy chain concentration. So we have IgG, IgD, IgE, signatory or dimer, IgA, and the pentamer. Of these three, which do you think can bind to the surface of a cell? That is, which ones have a free Fc, not bound up? Which ones have free Fcs?
IgG,
IgD, IgE. Okay. So all of these have the potential of binding on the surface itself. Whereas the dimer and the pentamer cannot bind on the surface of the cell because their Fc regions are not free. They're tied up with a J chain. And these are the 8x10 glossies of the same picture. Now this is a busy chart, and I don't want you to memorize most of this stuff. What I want you to do right now. First off, we're going to not make a distinction at this point for IgG. We're going to have all the various subclasses of IgG as well as IgA as a single entity. So we won't worry about various differences between them at this point. Notice that the half-life is roughly 20-some days here. So we'll say 23 is being typical. We won't worry about the we're going to say that IgG activates the classical system. So we're not going to worry about the minuses or the plus minuses. We're going to say it activates classical complement. More about what classical system means to that. We're going to say it crosses the placenta, even though we've got one that's sort of weird, it's plus minus. We're going to say IgG crosses the placenta. But that's what's going from mother to child. We're going to say that it has Fc receptors that bind to phagocytes, and the phagocytes are going to be a PMN. I'm going to say that occurs. Okay. It's not part of mucosal transport. And it's not involved with the mast cell. So it doesn't bind to the mast cell. IgA is does not activate classical complement, but put a little note there, it activates alternative complement. So there's a second way to activate a complement system, and IgA can do that. And here we're talking about the dimer, which is called secretory. And that's the one that's 600 pounds. Okay. Notice it's got a monomer on there that's 150,000. So the dimer doesn't cross the placenta. Doesn't bind to the phagocytes. That's true. Mucosal transport, yes, that's true. And it does not activate mast cells. In terms of IgM, notice that it's the largest one in size, so immune complexes with IgM, such as your first antibody, such as what we just talked about in terms of your kidney. If we have an immune complex with IgM, it's a very big one, the pentameric structure binds to multiple epitopes. Okay? Its size is going to be important that way. It activates complement in the classical pathway. It does not cross the placenta. Does not bind the negative thing. It does not bind to phagocytic cells because it doesn't have a free FC. Mucosal transport is possible, but we're going to really put that as plus minus. It's possible. And the activation of mast cells is a negative. IgE, its claim to fame is an extremely small amount in the bloodstream. This is the milligrams per milliliter. Okay. 0.0000. Basically, this is the synthesis rate. As soon as it's produced, it binds on the surface of the mast cell. The mast cells are in your tissue. That's that on your arm. And so we have mast cells in the tissue. And that's its main claim to fame. It's part of either protection against parasitic agents or type 1 hypersensitivity. IgE, we don't really know too much about. It binds on the surface of cells. It's present on the surface of the B cell. We don't know that much about what it does. It's a mystery. So we won't talk much about that one. So we pick out some things here, but it's not the memory of the whole thing. If we look at our first immune response, we inject a freshman or a guinea pig or something with antigen A. This is going to be IgM. And notice that it took us 14 days to get a response, to get our maximum response. We then give antigen A a second time, and we get a much greater response faster. And so it took us just about 6 days, or about half the time, to get the same level of response that we got initially. But within 14 days, we have a much higher response. Okay. This is called a memory response or amnestic response, the same root as the word amnesia. And this is the basis of immunization. We give you the primary response to the vaccine, and then you have a secondary response to the immunity. So secondary responses are characterized by more antibody, faster. And in the case of in the bloodstream, IgM gives us more IgG. It's our memory cell that comes that produces our second plasma cell upon our second exposure to the antigen. You take the memory cell and make a plasma cell. It's producing a different class of antibody. We went from an IgM, large antibody, to IgG. Okay. Now, in this particular freshman, we gave them a little twist. We gave them antigen B the second time. And of course, antigen B was going to give us a primary response. And this, of course, is going to be IgM. This is the first time we saw it. So the body can separate between what it's seen before and what it hasn't seen before. Now that's the idealized thing, and that's how I want you to understand it for a test. Little variations in reality. We have some weird things that happen. You see our primary and secondary responses are right here, the primary and the secondary. And most of what we see in primary is IgM. And most of what we see in secondary is IgG. And everything is as we told you, but there's a little couple of strange things. We don't understand that. And this, we have an idea why IgM. This could be that idea where we have selection between multiple epitopes. We give you a lot, and there's an immunodominance. And the first time you saw it, you didn't really respond to it. It's only the second time you saw it, you started to respond to it. So that might account for this secondary response, giving us an IgM. Remember, these are pooled sera, so each one is to a different kind of target on that collection of antigens that we expression on the animal. But we don't, so we have a sort of idea about this one, but we're not really sure about this one at all in terms of the IgG. So there are some variations, but if I ask you on a test, in the bloodstream, the primary immune response is IgM, and the secondary response is IgG. You can see that that's true 99% of the time, although reality is a little slightly different. If we were looking at secretory IgA, the secretory IgA response is nothing more than a series of repeated IgA, and we inject antigen repeatedly, you get this. So secretory IgA has no memory. The secretory IgA gives us this constant primary response thing. That's the Travis idea reason, where you had to be exposed to the antigen all the time to get that. If you're looking at someone having an allergic reaction, an IgE being involved, there's IgE, and then there's IgE. So if your immune system is responding by producing IgE, you have the typical primary, secondary kinetics, smaller amount of antibody, longer for the first time, more antibody, faster the second time. So if you are exposed repeatedly to what you're allergic to, you can produce higher and higher amounts of IgE, which makes things potentially worse and worse and worse. Here's our secretory IgA. There's a J chain we talked about. But also notice that we have a second piece down here called the secretory component. This allows it to be secreted on mucosal surfaces. And the diagram is shown here. So we have a plasma cell in the submucosal layer, underneath the epithelial cell. And the plasma cell secretes the dimeric structure. It then has the J chain on it already, there's the J chain. It then adds the secretory piece here. And then it moves to the lumen of the duct in this case. So we have this is what it looks like then. So that's secretory IgA. The monomeric IgA looks like this. So this is the monomeric. That's found in the serum. And function is not well understood, but we have some hints. We think what it's doing has nothing to do specifically with the immune response, but serum IgA may in fact be involved with downregulation of platelets, making platelets less sticky, that is, making them less likely to release mediators. You recall that platelets have all kinds of things inside, right? Clotting and so on. And that we're trying to downregulate them with altering the prostaglandins by giving aspirin and so on. You have it probably in physiology, you'll get it more later. But that kind of thing, sort of people with a history of clots and stuff, we try to make their platelets quiet. Well, maybe, we believe, the normal function of serum IgA is to do just that, is to quiet them down. Okay. And so we have some problems that we have with platelets in patients, and we actually give them normal serum. We didn't understand why that would work, but the reason why we think it works is we're loading in somebody else's serum IgA, which says, shh, quiet up. So I'm just watching the late television program with the monster screaming, and we just woke up the baby. We just go back to sleep later. Okay. So that's what secretory IgA seems to do, just to calm things down. So it's not really involved in a new response directly in that sense. But serum IgA, we have to look at it. And it's on any mucosal surface. Here it's shown in the gut. It's also found in tear film. It's found in saliva. It's found in the respiratory tract, vaginal flora. Anywhere we have a mucosal membrane, this is going to be secreted. It's going to come through the vaginal wall, through the lumen of the intestinal tract. It's like paint. It's like a wall that paints itself. It oozes through and sticks testing and a type 1 hypersensitivity. Type 1 is involved in protection against multicellular parasites. Here's our mast cell, a receptor site for IgE. That's the Fc of IgE. So it's sitting there ahead of time. Along comes the allergen, and it binds, creates a conformational change, a little wiggle, that then in turn activates the release mediator cytotoxicity. And again, this is why we think the evolutionary beginnings of antibody is just this kind of thing. And here we're seeing it as antibody. We see the same sorts of things relative to the overall superimmunoglobulin family, and they are the structures that serve the eyes and ears of the cell. It's only later evolutionary that they sort of fall off and we accumulate the bloodstream. Antibody variables. Varieties of antibodies. And we use oncobody. Remember, oncobodies are antibodies to antibodies. So we take a goat anti-human antibody. We talked about that when we talked about syphilis and stuff. Right? We can take a goat anti-human antibody, but it's not just sort of the abstract idea of antibody. It's maybe goat anti-IgG. So the heavy chain concentration of IgG, or mu, the heavy chain concentration of heavy chain region of IgM, or maybe cap or lambda. Okay. So we can look at into an antibody using an antibody as a reagent, a goat antibody as a reagent, and we can define class and type. Now, I'll give you an example to value that. We have a baby that's born whose mother is HIV positive. The baby has antibodies to HIV, as you'd expect, the IgG, the HIV that the mother made, because the mother was infected, is crossing the placenta and is found in the baby's bloodstream. But the question is the baby infected? The mere presence of the antibodies to HIV from the mother doesn't tell us that the baby's infected. In fact, we know statistically that if we don't treat with AZT, it's about a third of the children are HIV positive, but two-thirds aren't. But all children will have antibodies from the mother. So how do we know which ones are which are you in? Well, we know that IgM does not cross the placenta, that IgG does. So if you find an HIV, an antibody to HIV, that's an IgM to HIV, the baby's infected because the baby's responding in utero. If we find only IgG to HIV, we don't find IgM, then we can assume that baby was not infected. So the class is important. IgM to the pathogen in the baby's bloodstream, in their cord blood, tells us that the baby was infected. IgG tells us nothing about whether the baby was infected or not, because we know the mother just gave it. So a monoclonal antibody to heavy chain constant region, IgM distinguished from IgG, can tell us that within minutes of birth, so we know whether the baby is infected or not, and that would be a good thing to know. Okay? You'd much rather know what we're dealing with right away than wait for months and months and months and see if the baby develops an immunodeficiency. It's got AIDS. Okay? That would be a terrible time to wait. Especially, you know, the odds are that it's two-thirds no. Or if they're treated with the mother with AZT, it's only a handful of percent, maybe 2%. So that's an example of antibody to the class. An antibody to the type. You've probably heard of something called myeloma. Maybe even you've heard of something called multiple myeloma, a type of leukemia. A myeloma protein is an antibody. A myeloma protein is a protein produced by a B-cell tumor. Now, does the patient have many different kinds of B-cells that have gone goofy, or is there only one? As it turns out, we have the antibodies to the light chains that we can use that through. So antibodies to kappa, antibodies to lambda. If we find, and we can find these in the patient in their serum, if you find that the unusual antibodies have both kappa and lambda, and kappa antibody cell and lambda from another one, then we know that we have multiple B cells that have gone crazy, and we have multiple myeloma. But if all the antibodies are the same class, then we can assume that maybe we only have one problem. There's even patients that have leukemias in which they produce a single part of an antibody, like a light chain problem. We have a fancy term for that. A light chain problem is called a light chain gammopathy. Gamma, meaning antibody, pathy, meaning something wrong. Gammopathy. A light chain gammopathy is when we're producing only light chain. That was discovered by an Englishman with a hyphenated name back in the 60s. It wasn't common to have hyphenated names. Now we have lots of people like that. And his name was Bence Jones, B-E-N-C-E, Bence, B-E-N-C-E Jones. So Bence, hyphenated Jones, discovers this patient that have light chain hemopathies, and they are either kappa or lambda, and the light chain is small enough to come across in the urine. And so we take the patient's urine, we put it in a cold, it crystallizes this protein, we spin it down to the centrifuge, we add the appropriate reagent, antibody to kappa or antibody to lambda, and we can find out more about their light chain hemopathy. Is it one B cell or is it more than one B cell? So we can use these oncobodies to determine class and type. Now, in that heavy chain constant region, even though it's constant and there's not much change to it, right, you do have a few amino acid sequences in the heavy chain constant region where you put your own little unique genetic markers. It's sort of like your name on the side of the antibody. Designer antibody. John Smith. So it's your amino acid sequence. So I can really, you can actually distinguish your antibody from my antibody because we have the different genetic markers. We can have a goat antibody to that marker. We can have a goat antibody that will identify your antibody as distinct from mine. Those are called allotypes. So allotype is designer antibody. It's the amino acid sequences that make your antibody distinct from mine. Even though they're the same class, IgG, even though they're the same target for polio or whatever, it's yours versus mine. So I can distinguish your antibody from mine. And then finally, that binding site, that 3 to 5 amino acid residues of the variable regions of the heavy light to come together and interact with the epitope, we can make an antibody to that. Wow. An antibody to where antigen or epitope fits with antibody. Boy, that's a really interesting antibody. Okay. And that's called an antibody to the idiotype. Anti-idiotype. So if we talk about class and type, the targets for those would be the heavy chain of the concentration of the heavy and light chains, the antibody to IgM or kappa or IgG or whatever. Okay. We use those to distinguish the light chain hemopathies or the antibody to mother from the baby antibody. Allotypes are the genetic markers. That's self. So this is self. And these are the GM or genetic markers. And we can identify yours and mine. Now the genotype is a little bit different because remember this is going to be binding the goat antibody to the human antibody binding site for antigen. So, let's make a little funny drawing here. Maybe I'm going to go up to this too. Do you want to read about that? Thank you. imagine for a moment that we're making an antibody to an antibody binding site. This work was done by a fellow by the name of Roy in London, and he had patients who had cancer and he wanted to treat them. And we'll see how he did this. If we have an antibody to an antibody, and it's to the binding site, and that antibody is looking like antigen, is it binding to the binding site? So it's sort of like antigen-like, right? Everybody understand? It's like antigen because it's fitting in that stage sort of thing. So we can go to antibodies acting like an antigen. So what if we took the goat antibody, acting like antigen, and injected it into somebody? What would they respond with? And it turns out they respond by producing antibody. Antibody to the antigen that we never gave them. Again, remember it's the antibody that looks like antigen. And we use that as an antigen. We call it an anti-genotype vaccine. And it actually works like antigen. Bizarre. So Roy wanted the patient to develop antibodies of the tumor, but he didn't want to inject them with a tumor. So he injected them with antibodies to the antibodies. So there is such a thing as an anti-genotype vaccine. Where we use an antibody as an antigen. It's called an anti-genotype vaccine. So if we injected a patient with an anti-genotype vaccine, it would be an example of artificial active immunity. So Roy did this with patients that had tumors, and he wanted them to develop an antibody response to the tumor, but he didn't want to inject them with the tumor. So he used an anti-genotype vaccine and it worked. It was on. Question that came up, did that actually occur in humans? Do we like an antibody to our own antibodies? And the answer initially was no, that can't be. But ultimately we found that in fact that is the case. We produced a whole sort of network of antibodies to antibodies to antibodies to antibodies and antibodies to antibodies to the antibodies and so on. An extremely small amount that are only detected by very sensitive kinds of techniques. So we're back to almost over there. So what I was going to do is show you this diagnostic one. Here we have this equals the antigen, and this equals the anti-genotype antibody. So we take. We have the rabbits, and we're going to inject it with the antigen, and we're going to tear vein, and we're going to take out an antibody, okay, to the antigen. We then inject this, and we can see what we're doing. So we inject this into another animal. This in the animal near vein here. protein, you can have an immune response protein, and you can have antibody class. Like I said, we do have them in humans. For example, we can find these with very susceptible or very various kinds of very sensitive techniques. And we have antibodies to antibodies and antibodies to antibodies to antibodies and so on. But at one point we stopped, this is how we downgrade antibody activity. We don't think that anymore, but they do exist. The general idea of making antibody to an antibody is not unusual. Rheumatoid arthritis is pretty perfect, and that's an IgM and an IgG immune complex. An IgM and an IgG, a big antibody and a little antibody, getting trapped in joints and so on, activating the immune complex. So now we want to talk about the complement system. A little bit of complement already, we talked about acute inflammation. One important one, that is we made C3. Notice that C3 has got a big line on it. C3 is a long, C3 convertase, which activates this. C3 convertase is a long-lasting enzyme, and it converts a lot of C3 to C3A and B. Basically, taking C3 and breaking it up into pieces. Earlier enzymes last for maybe 10 or 15 seconds, just to get to the next step. C3 convertase lasts for 20 minutes or longer, creating lots and lots of components of C3A and B. They in turn attack 5, which then adds 6, 7, 8, 9, and when we have this components of 5B, and you can see them listed here, called MAC, that's membrane attack complex. MAC is membrane attack complex. If the target was a cell, these components will literally put a hole in the cell, resulting in lysis. It's literally an ionophore. Remember the ionophore in chemistry? Sort of like a donut with a privileged ionic exchange in the middle of the donut. They basically put the donut on the side of a cell. Sort of like the old Civil War mines. They would put a mine on the side of a wooden ship and then blow it off. It's the same sort of thing. If you put this ionophore structure composed of C5, B, 6, 7, 8, 9, and they make this structure, like a donut, it looks like a donut, it acts like a donut. This is ionophore, it results in lysis. So that's the classical pathway. IgM and IgG being part of the antigen complex. An alternative pathway can involve a variety of factors, and some of these factors are found on the surface of organisms, but also can be an immune complex with secretory IgA. So a new complex with IgA. We get a new complex there. And this can act in an alternative way. And notice we're getting to another C3 convertase, and we're coming at it from a different point of view. So there's a different way of doing it. It avoids the earlier steps, the 1, 4, 2, 3 steps, and goes basically through activating 3. So it's a shortcut. The alternative pathway discovered initially in the 1960s, when everybody else was studying the classical pathway, a fellow went to Atlantic City to tell everybody about his new discovery of secretory IgA and his alternative pathway. By the way, endotoxin can also activate a pathway to focus on all endotoxin. We'll find some other ways of doing things. But he went to the meeting saying there's other ways of doing things, there's endotoxin and there's the IgA pathway. And people booed at the meeting. And they got into it personal. Scientific arrogance is what it was. It wasn't personal. Anyway, he went back to his hotel room and jumped out the window and killed himself. He was really upset his graduate students because they were working on research. And so they picked up the ball and they eventually proved him right. Okay. So a guy died with that little arrow right there. Strange things happen. So we have alternative pathways and we have classical pathways. What we do want to know is what things are really going on. So we have, don't worry about who does it, but we want to know what happened. Cell lysis is possible, inflammation is possible, and in the inflammation we want to know we're going to be activating mast cells and basophils and eosinophils in the andromedy area. We have diathermesis and chemotaxis. Again, the lymphocyte here is going to be TMN. Platelets are becoming activated. That's always a dangerous sign. Going down the line, we also have opsonization of antigens. Viral neutralization. The complement activation components will, along with antibody, will help coat the target of the virus, preventing receptor site matching. And ultimately, we can get rid of the immune complex. We want to know the biological activity. Don't worry too much about the components. You may see a term that you should be familiar with, membrane attack factor, MAC. That's a biological activity we talked about. Amphotoxin means activation of mast cells. When you see that term, that refers to. So this is nothing more than a better drawing of the drawing that I drew earlier. This is acute inflammation. part, and so we have, we'll not worry about this, we won't worry about that, we won't worry about this, we won't worry about this. Okay. So basically, we're going to have the antigen coming in, and this is our antigen here, the tissue damage that we talked about, complement activation that occurs. We activate either the classical or the alternative pathway, depending on what kind of antibody we got. We have PMNs leaving the blood vessel. Okay. All of this is what we want to know. Mast cells, we talked about mast cells producing histamine and all of that. All right. So this is how the textbook is going to have. It's acute inflammation, but also has some other things into it. So the drawing was a bit earlier, probably more precise in terms of just showing you acute inflammation. This shows you some other stuff. Again, more just trying to reinforce toxin inflammation, complement-mediated lysis, phagocytosis, and polytoxin, meaning the activation of mast cells. Again, avoid the, our discussion of lymphocytes and macrophages. Don't worry about that. Everything else on this one will be pretty much true. We've got neutrophils, and mast cells, and stuff like that. Finally, just mention, when we have the activation of mast cells, we have a couple of pathways that you should be familiar with in general sense. One is the arachidonic acid pathway, results in prostaglandin activity and leukotriene activity. Okay. Prostaglandin and leukotriene, this is coming from the mast cell. So in addition to histamine being released, we also have the activation of the arachidonic acid pathway, prostaglandin and leukotriene, and they're going to enhance some of the activity of the histamine. So sort of look at it here. We have constriction and platelet aggregation, permeability increase, vasodilation, neutrophil chemotaxis. Notice that we have a little bit of dilation in constriction, competing forces. Leukotrienes are sometimes called the slow reacting substance of anaphylaxis, SRS-A, slow reacting substance of anaphylaxis. Histamine has its effect in minutes and wanes in about 2 days. Slow-reacting substance of anaphylaxis, or leukotriene, picks up about 2 days and continues maybe for another 5 days. So the same kind of effects in the body. And you can see that we have a platelet activation and chemotaxis and so on. So arachidonic acid pathway, we'll know a lot more about this later. Obviously, prostaglandin activity, we talk about aspirin.